Harold Varmus is one of the most accomplished scientists of our time and one of the few who has also mastered the art of politics. He won a Nobel Prize in medicine for a major breakthrough in cancer research and then went on to head the National Institutes of Health under President Clinton. These days, he's the president of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and co-chair of President Obama's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. He describes what it's like to navigate the political and scientific worlds in his new memoir, The Art and Politics of Science, which is published by Norton. It is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Harold Varmus to our show. And forgive me, I put a cough drop in when I started that, and it's doing all sorts of weird things to my mouth, but I'm still fighting a cough. Welcome to our show.
Very much, Leonard. Nice
to
be here.
Didn't you write your master's thesis on Charles Dickens?
Well, that was my undergraduate thesis, and fortunately, Harvard's main requirement that I had to overcome to get a master's in English was to show some competence in Greek. And as the test revealed, especially in the absence of a dictionary, I wasn't all that competent, even though Xenophon had been the one writer I had tried to read.
So Greek kept you from staying in
literature? No, I passed that exam. What kept me from staying in literature was a desire to exercise whatever talents I had in science and medicine. And I was also moved by a feeling of jealousy when I met my classmates from Amherst College, who seemed to be having more fun at Harvard Medical School than I was having at English graduate school.
But you still seem to have been split, literature, English, politics, journalism.
Life is full of rich treasures, and I'll try to enjoy as many as possible.
And how old were you when you decided to eventually go into medicine?
Well, I decided to go to medical school a couple of times. The first time I decided not to do it, and then it was only a year later, I was 22,
it was only slightly deferred. But many people go into science, make the decision when they're very young.
I think it was
In fact, do a lot of their serious work before they're even 22 years old.
I think life is different at that transition stage of leaving college and thinking about your career at this point. And people say, you know, 30 is what 20 used to be. And I see a lot of young people who are interested in science and medicine spending a few years off, either working in laboratories or doing something entirely different. And it was actually unusual in my medical school class that there were a few of us who had spent one or two or three years doing other things. Most people had stayed in a pretty narrow track, but we're talking about the early 60s when life wasn't on a fast track.
Did your parents expect you to become a doctor? You grew up in Long Island?
I grew up in Long Island. My father was a general practitioner and Jewish ancestry, and there was, you know, there's also always a something of an expectation. But my parents were, I think, a little, I'm not quite sure what the right word is here, but they, while they accepted the idea when I was in high school that I might become a doctor, when they saw me veer off into another track aiming toward literature and a career as a teacher, they took a certain amount of pride. My, you know, their friends and relatives thought, you know, that the correct destiny for someone of my background was to be a doctor, and they liked defending my position. So they were sort of shocked when I decided that I was going to go to medical school after all.
But then you didn't become a GP. You got into experimental science.
That's true. Unfortunately, my parents didn't see all that much of that. They saw me veer off at the NIH when I was there to fulfill some obligatory military requirement during the Vietnam War. But I only became really deeply committed to science in my early 30s, and unfortunately my parents had severe illnesses and died about that time.
Well, at the NIH, you were working in Ira Pastan's laboratory as a clinical associate, and that was your you were working with bacterial gene regulation.
I went to medical school thinking I was interested in psychiatry and putting my literature background together with an interest in taking care of patients, and then I found that I didn't have the temperament to sit in a room with a psychotic patient and do very well at that. And so the consequence,
you didn't want to
was,
hear all the kvetching.
Well, it wasn't kvetching. I just felt I couldn't handle this very well. I wasn't really equipped to do it, and I have great respect for people who can. And then along the way through medical school, and especially once I reached the NIH, I began to learn that the disease was understandable in molecular terms, and that I found very exciting. And that, you know, my indoctrination in the Pastan lab at the NIH was a rough one because I had intended to go to the NIH to work on some disease, endocrinology or immunology or cancer, and I was thrust into a lab environment that had originally one time been the study of the thyroid gland, and suddenly Ira saw the power of using bacteria as models for gene regulation and control by hormones. That opened me up not just to modern thinking about biological science, but also to the power of using simple models to ask really big questions. That was transforming for me.
How much was that linked to what you did later at UCSF, the University of California, San Francisco, where you did the work that eventually led to your sharing a Nobel Prize?
Well, actually, methodologically and maybe the right word is heuristically, very closely linked. That is, the kinds of approaches I took as a scientist in a group in San Francisco were very similar to the kinds of molecular approaches we took to a problem in bacteria. Again, we were working with a simple model, a chicken virus that causes cancer, to try to understand bigger things about cancer. I had moved into cancer research because I really wanted to be connected, even while I was doing basic work, with something that was obviously disease-related. It just seemed to make better use of my background as a physician.
You were working on retroviruses.
Yes, well, which everyone now, a term that people do recognize
because of HIV,
which was, of course, not known at that point.
And what were you looking into, how they transform genes?
Well, you have to go back a little bit historically here and remember that we didn't have the Human Genome Project. We didn't even have recombinant DNA technology in the early 70s. All we really had was some very simple methods for studying a small organism with genetic tools and with some molecular tools, but a very, very simple approach to these problems. And cancer, we know, arises from normal cells. Our cells have tens of thousands of genes. And the only way, it seemed to me and to others, possible to begin to understand what was wrong at a molecular or genetic level in a cancer cell was to use some simple tool. And that tool was presented to us through retroviruses and a couple of other classes of viruses that have only a few genes and yet have the power to make a normal cell into a cancer cell.
Now, there are so many different kinds of cancers, we've learned.
Sure.
Some are treatable, some are not treatable. But do they all have this in common?
Well, we haven't really gotten to the big step forward here. And the point of using a chicken virus that caused an unusual type of cancer, a sarcoma in chickens, was that the virus, while only having a couple of genes, had all the information necessary for the virus to grow and for the virus to change the behavior of a cell in culture or a cell in the animal. So we were just trying to ask a fundamental question. What did that gene do? Where did it come from? And the discovery for which we were later...
You never win it the same year.
Pardon me?
You never win the Nobel the same year.
No,
it's
no,
usually 10 years later or
well,
so.
Well, that's right. And in this case, I think people had to understand that the discovery we made, which was that the gene that the virus uses to cause a cancer is a gene that is derived from a normal version of the same gene. And that gave rise to a new way of thinking about cancer. And it wasn't until many other examples had been discovered and it was clear that the class of genes we had discovered actually play a role in human cancer, not through viruses most commonly, most often through mutations that can arise in a variety of ways that change the behavior of a normal cell, make it behave cancerous.
Has that been applicable to any treatments for cancer?
Absolutely. I tried to describe in the book some of the places where this general concept of how cancer arises has become important in dealing with human cancer. For example, there are several examples, and I don't mean to abuse anyone who's involved in some of the others, but perhaps the most powerful example is the study is in the treatment of a disease called chronic myeloid leukemia, where we know exactly what the mutation is. It's a highly reproducible mutation. The mutation affects the enzymatic activity of a protein against which we have a very powerful drug. And actually now there are at least three powerful drugs approved by the FDA. Patients who had this disease usually faced a fatal outcome within 5 to 7 years. Now These patients can chronically take a drug that has only very mild toxicity and expect to live a normal lifespan.
My guest is Harold Varmus, president of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, former director of the NIH. He's written a book called The Art and Politics of Science, which is published by W.W. Norton and Company. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lope. Do you see this book as a memoir?
It's a memoir, but it's also one that includes probably very little of my love life and a lot of politics, science, and major issues that affect science that I hope will be of interest to a broad audience.
Well, you did wind up marrying a journalist, so
I
you
did.
Took care of that side of your interest.
I mentioned things, but I don't. But it's not a book about my social life in any sense. And it's sad to write a memoir in which you actually leave a lot of your friends and relatives pretty much on the cutting room floor.
Winning the Nobel Prize really is the pinnacle of most people's careers. But you did all sorts of other stuff, some of it before you won the Nobel. But did that change your life?
I see it as an inflection point. You know, obviously, it's a lot of fun to win a Nobel Prize.
And they give you money, too, don't they?
Well, the money goes very quickly. You know, it gets taxed in the U.S. And especially in those days, it wasn't that much. And I had to split it with my pal, Mike Bishop. And, you know, it did go as quickly. You give some of it away. You have some fun with some of it. And that's gone. What's important, though, and what proved to be very important in my own life, is the potential for having influence in other spheres of life that affect science, especially politics.
Is that what brought you back to the East? Because you were at University of California, San Francisco for a long time, weren't you?
Well, I was there for 23 years, and I had become interested in how government influences science even earlier than the Nobel Prize, but that puts you in a special position to try to articulate the aspirations and problems faced by the scientific community. And I'd gotten quite interested in how the NIH works and how Congress supports it. And in 1993, after a few years of taking a fairly active role through some very worthwhile organizations that were generated by scientific societies that support this kind of activity, I was asked by the Clinton administration to become director of NIH. That brought me back to the East Coast.
Had you lost interest in doing research?
No. In fact, I've all through this period of running the NIH and being the president of Memorial Sloan Kettering, I've maintained my own lab, smaller than the lab I once had at University of California, San Francisco. But I like to think that we are continuing to be productive and do some good work.
What was the state of the NIH when you arrived there?
Well, there were a couple of problems. One is that the rate of success of applicants for grants had fallen for reasons that are a little technical and perhaps kind of boring to your audience, but having to do in part with the way budgets had been allocated over the previous few years. And on the other side, there was the NIH is a complex organization. It has what we call an intramural program of government scientists, several thousand in number, who work in Bethesda. But the biggest job of the NIH is to give out federal funds to grantees all over the country, indeed all over the world. That accounts for about 90% of the activity, 10% internal. And both sides were dispirited for various reasons. And I saw morale building, reinforcing peer review, trying to address problems of grant allocation and definition of what we did, making the NIH more prominent, explain to Congress why it was important. And all those things helped lead to a very dramatic increase in the NIH budget over the last few years that I was there.
There is a lot of infighting over who gets grants, isn't there? I always hear complaints from people who say, well, my illness, whatever it is that I am talking about, claims many lives or destroys many people's lives, but it's not the hot thing right now. Or cancer was always important, and then it was replaced by HIV/AIDS.
Well, I think we have to distinguish between two kinds of dilemmas in distributing NIH funds. One is the setting of priorities by the NIH, and obviously the very structure of the NIH with many so-called categorical institutes that are devoted to different diseases or different disciplines creates a kind of envelope for the level of funding for different kinds of problems. And then each of the institutes, of which there are now 27, a difficult management problem in its own right, another topic we could discuss,
But, so you were learning how to be administrative at the same time that you were thinking about the big scientific issues.
Yeah, I'll just let me finish this one point about the fact that there is the priority setting issue, which is in the hands of institute directors and their colleagues. But there's also, and very importantly from the point of view of grant applicants, the peer review process by which anyone's grant submission is evaluated by peers, people from the outside who come to NIH, review grants, decide which ones are best. And you know that is also a potentially contentious process. What are the criteria? Are we awarding people who have a great likelihood of succeeding and going the next step? Or are we denying people who have fantastically innovative ideas with chances of 1 in 10 of producing something great?
Right. The people who complain that any kind of out-of-the-box thinking does not get rewarded.
But as we are now in a period of a very tight funding, I mean, the NIH budget has grown, but then it remained flat for about 6 or 7 years and has fallen way behind inflation. And the result is that the scientific community and the enterprise has grown, the number of applicants has increased, but the number of new grants has fallen. And in that spirit, new investigators, people with particularly novel ideas, are going to lose out to people who have the experience of being productive and are taking more conventional approaches that are likely to give results but may not make the great discoveries that would come from innovation. But one person's innovation is someone else's nuttiness.
How much of the pressure comes from the politicians?
We've been reasonably well protected. NIH has a tradition of receiving money in a way that is pretty much free of earmarks. And that's been a very healthy thing. Now, there's always, of course, a tendency to try to influence the NIH in a way. And there is something we call report language in the appropriation bill, which does influence the way people think. But, you know, Congress is a representation of the public, and Congress should state its views about what NIH is doing. They are an oversight group for a very large level of spending. But what I don't like to see requirements that such and such number of dollars should go to an institution in a congressman's district. And we've been blissfully free of that for many years.
Are we likely to see more money coming for basic research as a result of the bailout bill?
Well, we have indeed, thanks to the advocacy by the administration and in particular by Senator Arlen Specter, have over $10 billion in so-called ARRA, the American Recovery Act, that will benefit the NIH. It needs to be spent, for the most part, within 2 years, but it should allow us to do a lot of novel things, spend money in interesting ways that help improve the scientific infrastructure, buy equipment that hasn't been possible to purchase over the last few years, continue some construction projects, and importantly, get a lot of young new investigators off to a good start.
You keep on suggesting that there have been problems over the last few years. We'll take a little break. When we come back, maybe we'll address a few of those and talk about some other things, including your continued interest in the arts. I gather you're involved in some poetry project.
Oh, you may have seen the ad in the New York Times today. Yes, I'm going to be reading at Alice Tully Hall on April 1st. I'm excited about that.
Harold Varmus is my guest. His book, The Art and Politics of Science, is published by Norton. Stay with us for more. We're back with Harold Varmus, the head of Memorial Sloan Kettering. He's written a book called The Art and Politics of Science, and it is published by Norton. So we've heard from a lot of scientists that things were not great for the sciences during the last 8 years. Did science become more politicized under the Bush administration?
You know, there's always an interaction between science and government. There has to be. And I think what was most troubling to most of us who were following this closely was a collapse of the traditional relationship between science and government. The way this works best, scientists provide the best available information, public figures, elected or not, make policy decisions based on unadulterated information. And in many instances, there were collapse of that system. There were ways in which the Bush administration was, did some good things. I don't want to paint a totally black picture. It was not a good time for science, but you know, there was a commitment to spending more on global health and through the president's emergency plan on AIDS relief. Many people began to receive antiretroviral therapy. That was good. First few years of Bush's administration, the NIH continued to receive the promised increases in its budget. But then there was neglect, and there was neglect across the board, and budgets fell, and science didn't prosper.
One of the flashpoints has been stem cell research, and there was a recent article by Peter Steinfels in the New York Times. He writes about religion and related matters, and he said that he thought it was appropriate for politicians to get involved in this kind of debate because it's not just a purely scientific debate.
Sure, and we agree with that. And throughout the background here, as I think most of your listeners probably know, because stem cell research became a political issue.
And it is again now.
And, well, it's been a major political issue for the last 7 or 8 years, a pivotal point here was President Bush's declaration on August 9, 2001, that federal funds could not be used to support work on stem cells derived after his speech. That policy was just reversed last Monday by President Obama in Washington, and that was the occasion of Steinfeld's story. No one has ever said that this is an area in which only scientists should speak. Scientists should be providing information and engaged in creating guidelines, but those committees are always peopled as well by people who are ethicists and physicians and members of the general community.
Well, how do you get past it? If some people believe that stem cell research can lead to major breakthroughs, others say, yes. Well, even supporters, some say, well, it will only have limited applications, but they're worthwhile to pursue. And others say that this is the destruction of life in a way, you know, in pursuit of some scientific advances. How do you get past that?
Well, you can't get unanimity in an area like this. Not everybody is going to agree to the same thing.
But I mean, you can't put up a firewall.
Well, you could actually do that in some sense. In the U.S., for better or for worse, we've tended to focus our arguments around what federal funds can be used for, whereas in England they take a position that something can be done or can't be done. The Congress has the capacity to exclude all stem cell research for funding. It's not going to happen because the public supports stem cell research in general. We all understand there's a balanced argument here, and I think one of the things that does disturb me is that the ethics of the argument always seem to be much more focused on the embryo than on the many ill patients who could benefit from stem cell research. And I think that's a very important thing to stress. No one can promise that any line of research is going to lead to benefit, but the experience we've had in medical research in general, I think, gives a lot of credence to the idea that stem cells are a very important area of research. We may not do things ultimately by taking cells from embryos, either embryos that have been created for research purposes or embryos that are stored, left over, about to be destroyed in fertility clinics. But there are now other ways to generate stem cells. We don't know what the ultimate outcome is going to be, but it would be ridiculous to pursue this incredibly promising area of research with all the disease and disability that could be relieved by it with one hand tied behind our backs.
You're a proponent of open access. What's open access?
Well, I believe that the Internet has fundamentally changed the way scientists can or should communicate with each other.
Haven't they guarded their secrets in the past in hopes of winning Nobel Prizes?
Well, no. First of all, you can't win a Nobel Prize if you guard your secret. You've got to go out there and tell people what you've done. When people publish their work, they do want it to be read. But we have a tradition of in publishing in the scientific world of publishing in journals that are sold by subscription. And because the publishers have a vested interest in keeping things to subscribers, at least in the first 6 months or year or longer, people who don't have those resources, someone like yourself who might want to look something up, people who belong to disease advocacy groups, someone who's trying to do research in Asia or Africa, could, in fact, with a change in the model for publishing, have access immediately. And that model is a very simple change. It involves saying that when a scientist has a paper accepted following peer review for publication, that paper will immediately appear on the internet, and the author, which actually means the agency that funded the author's work, will pay the modest fee, $1,000, $2,000, to allow the work of the journal to be done. But this means that from then on, the article is freely available. It's deposited in a digital library. You can find it when you go and you type in Alzheimer's disease and someone's name. That's the name of a researcher. You can immediately see the list of papers that are published and connect with those. And that's a radical change that we think is not only going to make information more accessible, but change the way science is actually practiced.
10 years ago, you attempted to launch eBiomed. What reaction did the science publishing industry have to that?
Well, they didn't like it. eBiomed is another way of saying basically making literature available immediately. And I have to say, as I say in the book when I discuss this topic, that my initial concept, this eBiomed document, was a bit naive about what it costs to publish and how one can recover the costs. But the eBiomed idea did have an immediate consequence that has proved to be very important, namely the creation of a digital library for full-text articles at the NIH. And now Congress has gotten on board and said that all work that's published by NIH-funded investigators must be in PubMed Central, which is the outgrowth of eBiomed, within a year, and I think that may soon change to 6 months, of the time of publication. And agencies around the world have done very similar things, sometimes earlier than Congress did, so that increasingly the full text of the scientific literature will be available in roughly 6 months after publication.
And you have the support of most people in the sciences, don't you?
I do, but as I describe in some detail, science is a rich and interesting culture. It's quite conservative from many points of view. People show high allegiance to the journals that they've always enjoyed publishing in and reading, and they will be loyal to many of those journals. Some of them are published by the societies that have been good to them in other ways. Some of the societies are dependent upon revenues from their journals to support their staff. So these changes are occurring slowly, but they are occurring, and they're occurring with a high degree of predictability at this point, and I think we're heading toward an open-access world.
Harold Varmus is my guest. He's written a book called The Art and Politics of Science. It's published by Norton. Barack Obama has said that he will restore science to its rightful place. I'm not sure I know what he means by that. Since you're an advisor to Barack Obama, how much of a commitment do you think he has? You're the co-chair of President Obama's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology,
yes.
Aren't you?
Yes.
How influential is the council?
Well, that remains to be seen. Of course, we're just assembling the council now, and it's got a checkered history. It was first invented under a slightly different name in the Eisenhower era. It's had its ups and downs. President Nixon abolished it because people who were members of the council didn't agree with some of his own thoughts about defense. But my co-chairs and I, Eric Holland and John Holdren, who's the science advisor and actually works in the White House, have high ambitions for bringing energetic people from many scientific disciplines into a group that provides a lot of good information. But let me try to explain this famous statement of President Obama's about putting science in its rightful place. The thing that draws many of us to him and is thinking about science in our society is the connection he makes between science and technology and many other big areas he's concerned about. Education is required to build a scientific and technologically skilled workforce. He recognizes that our great industrial enterprises are built on science and technology, and they drive the economy. He knows that our military forces and security are based on science, that many aspects of our entertainment world are based on it, that he's concerned about health care. Health care is, again, very heavily determined by the productivity of medical science. He's worried about energy resources. And again, we've, as a nation, given too little to energy research. He's concerned about our loss of environmental integrity, and he recognizes that ecologists and oceanographers and people concerned about air quality, all of whom are science and technology-based, are going to be essential to make progress in these areas. So he sees a vision of a new society that is very much based on science and technology.
Well, to do this, we need more scientists. And right now, our colleges are going through serious economic crises. Many of them have lost a lot of money in their endowments and are cutting back on scholarships. And I don't know whether fewer people are going into the sciences, but I suspect that's been the case for a while.
Well, some argue that the attractions of a career in Wall Street have diminished and that this might be an incentive for many people to think more about science and technology as a place to go. It's clear that the nation is going to be committed to the areas of science and technology over the next several years, and I think it looks pretty promising.
Now, I mentioned earlier you're also a lover of the arts. Is that rare in scientists?
No, not at all. No, many of my colleagues have not only enjoy the cultural offerings of a place like New York, but have been even more engaged than I've been. They've written books. They play music. They appreciate the arts. When I go to the opera, as I did last night, I expect to run into my fellow scientists, as I did last night.
What's happening at Memorial Sloan Kettering? What have you been able to do there over your tenure at the hospital?
Right. Well, of course, there are the things one simply has to do as a director of an academic health center: maintain the quality of our clinical care, be sure our staff is happy, and so forth. But I'd say the biggest single theme that I'd like to emphasize in my own time there has been the effort to bring our research enterprise closely together with the clinical enterprise. We've built a grand new research building that emphasizes research that is directly applicable to problems that are faced by cancer patients and by all of us who are at risk of getting cancer. We've built a new graduate school called the Gerstner Sloan Kettering Graduate School, which gives a degree in cancer biology and expects people in the course of a PhD to learn what cancer means and view basic science through the prism of disease.
Well, didn't Richard Nixon declare war on cancer and said that it would be cured within 25 years?
Yes, I think that was probably a mistake. It was good to invest more money into cancer and draw attention to cancer as a public health problem.
Is it the problem that there are so many different cancers, or that it's just more complicated?
Yes.
In the same way that our effort to cure HIV/AIDS has turned out to be a lot more complicated than we originally imagined.
We've had great success with HIV/AIDS in the sense that we do have, for the first time, medicines that control a viral infection. There are very few viral infections that can be treated as effectively as HIV. Not to say that it's perfect, and we have failed to develop a vaccine, but there was never a simple promise to deliver. I think the liability of the cancer war has been not the increased funding, which has been good for science generally, but the definition of a goal as a 25-year goal when, as you point out, there are many different kinds of cancer. We didn't really understand in 1971 when Nixon made that claim anything about how cancer actually arises. And we have made progress, but we're continually besieged by articles that say, why did we lose the war on cancer? When in fact, we're making a lot of progress. Death rates are coming down. We have new drugs. Living with cancer is much easier than it used to be. It's no longer a disease whose name we dare not speak, and many of our patients are living quite well with cancer.
Harold Varmus's book, The Art and Politics of Science, is published by W.W. Norton & Company. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure, as always, Leonard. Thank you.